this evening we're going to present two lessons. We'll present the first lesson called How and Why to Study History. And this lesson is going to be a necessary foundation. I didn't used to present it, but I discovered if we don't present why we study history, people suffer kind of a shock when they get into history and find out some things they never heard before that might be true. And they don't want to believe they're true. And it's a struggle for some people. And we'll talk about this. And it's called cognitive dissonance. And so I'll get into this first lesson. The second lesson is the Republic of Republics. I've decided to give that one next time we come. It's a vital lesson. It's a basic lesson about American history. Absolutely unbelievable what we were never taught when we went to school. The one we're going to give this evening, number one and number three, state sovereignty. And I'll explain why we're giving state sovereignty, because it's sweeping the nation right now. State sovereignty is a sleeping giant about to be aroused. And it's being aroused by the state legislatures. And so we'll give you more on that one as we present that lesson. And that's why I chose this third lesson as our second lesson this evening. Other lessons that we'll be back to give in January and February. We'd like to do three more evenings to cover the whole course. Natural law. The foundation of a free society is natural law. It's the laws of nature and of nature's God spoken of by Thomas Jefferson in the Declaration of Independence. A whole evening's lesson, or at least an hour and a half on that one. Original intent, rise to empire. Empire of debt. That's not a hard one to sell. Embracing global governance. That's where we are right now. We're just in the final stage of embracing global governance as our president goes to Copenhagen next month and finalizes the Copenhagen Treaty, and probably will do it by some kind of an executive order. And we will then be involved with the great United Nations program to save the planet from anthropogenic heating or something like that. And advancing freedom in the 21st century. Some people say to me, one lady particularly, she says, I really like your lectures, Mr. Pratt, but they're too long. Can't you just tell us what to do? Okay, we had 18 or 20 hours of lesson material, and this is the boiled down version. If you want the long version, we can do that also. This evening's lesson, How and Why to Study History, the Bare Naked Truth versus the Official Literature. Official literature? What are we talking about here? Now, nobody questions that we're in an awful situation. There's not a person in this room that doesn't know America is in an awful situation. Continued destruction of the unborn. It's appalling, absolutely appalling. Something like 50 million little ones have been murdered since our Supreme Court passed Roe versus Wade. This goes on and on. It's just we don't even pay any attention to it. Spending $53,000 per second with the monthly interest on the national debt of $30 billion. That's going on as I talk. National Socialist Healthcare Plan is imminent. It will pass. We will soon have it, whether we like it or not. The Copenhagen Treaty in December. It'll be upon us, and our president will embrace it. We have become a nation of illiterates. Now, I think the fifth one is the problem for the previous four. And we live in what was called the information age, I was told. Why, at the tips of your fingers, you can run your fingers on the computer. You can call up anything. Anything. I'm told. I haven't done it before, but in fact, I don't even have access to the web. I'm not too sure how you do that. But I'm told you can find out about anything. And so I call my friend and says, I want to know about something. I'll give them some topic. And a few minutes later, they call me back. No, it's faster than that. While I'm yakking on the phone, they call it up and tell me what I want to know. But we're a nation of illiterates. We're calling up the wrong subjects. We're not paying attention to our freedom. Our liberty is gone. Our country's being destroyed. And so in the information age, we are in a disinformation age, personally, individually. The greatest challenge facing mankind may be distinguishing reality from fantasy and truth from propaganda in this disinformation age. Now, we're going to define that in this first lesson. An old book. I've been learning more from old books lately than from new books. I love the old books. If it's 150 years old, I just get excited about it. I find out those people knew something back then, and they shared it. But their books have been discarded and abandoned and shoved off into the dustbin of history. Now, one of those old books said, writing a history book is like the work of an apothecary. And I wasn't even sure what an apothecary was, so I had to look up apothecary. That was like today's pharmacist. The pharmacist would go to the shelf. In the old days, the apothecary would go to the shelf, and he would take from these bottles, and he'd pour a little of this and a little of that into another bottle, and pretty soon he'd have a mixture here, and this would be the remedy to solve all your problems. Yes, and you go home and drink a spoonful of that every day. Well, he said writing history books is the same way. The historian, the student, the author, he goes to different books. He takes a little from this book and a little from that book, and he pours them all together, and he shakes it up, and he gives it his own spin. And that's a new book. Oh, have you read the latest book? Well, what if some of the bottles are contaminated? What if they have false educational ideas in them? Then your history book with good intentions will also be polluted. And I'm going to give you several examples, exactly four, this evening, showing what happened. This is a sample of a library shelf. Now, that's my shelf. That's some of the books that I read. And not that you're going to read those titles now, but you see these books were all written by someone. And they took a little from this book and a little from that book, and they poured them all together and spin with their own spin, and that's just another book. So how do we decide what to read? How and why do we study history? Thomas Paine had some great thinking in his little book, Common Sense. It opens up with this statement: a long habit of not thinking a thing wrong gives it a superficial appearance of being right. Now, there are some topics for a long time we haven't thought them wrong. Supposedly American history, we haven't thought it wrong. And so we grew up thinking it must be right. I'm going to show you tonight that we've been misled. We've been given false educational ideas that are distorting our thinking and ruining our country. I like this author. Uncle Eric, he calls himself, Richard Maybury. He's got 11 books in his series. I have several of his sets on the back table. For some reason, people enjoy Uncle Eric. He writes it like a 14-year-old would read. They're not like college books at all. It's like you'd expect your teenager to read if they were forced to read history. He writes in a way that you can enjoy on a variety of subjects. So if you've never tried Uncle Eric, give Uncle Eric a try. In chapter 13 of this particular book, he titles the chapter Cognitive Dissonance. And then defines it: the emotional stress that occurs when a person encounters a fact or persuasive idea that disagrees with his or her model. Now, have you ever been going through life and then someday somebody will say something to you that disagrees with what you think is true? Ever had that happen? Yeah, and how does that make you feel? Oh, contentious, huh? Or maybe, you can't be right, I'll defend my opinion. Okay, this is cognitive dissonance. Somebody comes along and, well, there's a better way to say it. It's the truth that hurts. That's the same thing, basically. Now, you received this handout this evening. I do not believe I can read a book and not find something in it that disagrees with some other book. And so you have to decide who's telling the truth if either is true. This is a challenge. Now, this is one of my favorite American heroes. I love this man, John McManus, president of the John Birch Society. I first heard him speak in Provo 30 years ago. And I remember his speech turned my heart on. I thought, wow, what a great speaker. He did something for me like maybe perhaps I've done for others. And I was thrilled with John McManus that night. And he just wrote another book, this little one I gave you. He kept it short and snappy so maybe you'd read it. I have a son, and I say, son, you ought to read this great big thick tome. You'd learn something from it. Well, he says, Dad, if it was only 50 pages, I might read it. And so John McManus has provided us 38 pages, and most of you might read it because it's only 38 pages, and he does a good job. But there isn't a book comes through my hands now that I read, and I say, hey, he blew it here and here and here and here. And so I put what I call red flags in the books. A red flag is a sticky tab from the dime store. I put a little sticky tab on that page, and I write down why I think he was wrong. Well, I put four sticky tabs in this book. And then I put one in that says, blackout, why didn't you include? And when I got done reading his book, I wrote him a letter. And dear John, you know, why did you do this? And why did you make these mistakes? That's not very nice, is it? It's a brand new book. He's my hero, and I'm pointing out his errors. Yes, yes. Be critical of everything you read. I gave him a nice donation also to be assure him that I still believe in him and I love him. Okay, here, I'm not going to tell you what the errors are. I'm going to let you find the errors out for yourself. You do your own homework. You become your own thinker. On page 7 of that little book that you're taking home and hopefully going to read, on page 7, he starts out with the Second Bank of the United States. The Second Bank of the United States. He starts his little short story trying to show how America has been polluted and corrupted and almost destroyed. He's showing that story. And so I wrote him a letter and I said, you made 4 errors in the book, and now I'm asking, why did you start with the Second Bank and not the first one? This was his answer. Quote in his letter, each of the corrections you suggested shall be included in subsequent printings of the booklet. Okay, no discussion, no argument. Each of the 4 suggestions will be included. And then this interesting thought, and this is where cognitive dissonance comes in. He wasn't ready in this book to stir you up and make you angry and upset about him. About Alexander Hamilton. See, this is where I said, why didn't you start with the First Bank of the United States? About Alexander Hamilton, I am aware of his dangerous attitudes, but I thought it best to avoid mentioning him in what I wrote. That part of U.S. history must wait for another day. Okay, I'm going to give you the other day tonight. It's the second half of this lesson. And some of my friends came up at the end of an evening, and they're not my friends anymore. The the emotional stress that it caused them when they heard what I had to say was too hard for them to take. And they haven't spoken to me since. Let's see how you handle it. Now, it's the second half of the evening. That's what we're going to present. The rest of the story. Okay, I just gave you this summary. These are the lessons. We'll be back in January and February and present those. Reading is my favorite way of learning. Yes, it's nice to hear a speaker, but the real bottom line for learning is reading. Now, Ivan Eland is a good scholar. I enjoy his work. This is the second one of his books I've read comprehensively. The first one was The Empire Has No Clothes, and he exposes American history and does a fine job. He's a scholar with the Independent Institute. This particular book, and this almost looks like a photograph, do you suppose they're really doing that at Mount Rushmore? Do you think they have really taken off the faces of those presidents? It looks like it to me. He goes through here and talks about how we judge presidents and how we evaluate their record and what their score should be, where they place. Who is number 1? Who is number 2? I went to Idaho a few months ago and gave a speech or two. I gave actually 18 hours of speeches up there in 2 days at the University in Idaho Falls. And one of the local political science professors responded in the newspaper denouncing what I had said. Denouncing it! As everybody knows that Abraham Lincoln is the greatest president that ever lived. It was in February, you know, Lincoln Day. Well, is he? Apparently, Ivan Eland doesn't think so because I don't see that face on Mount Rushmore in Ivan Eland's cover here. How do we judge when we read history? What's true and what's false? What should be our standard? And so Ivan Eland says, I have picked the standard to judge the presidents of peace, prosperity, and liberty. And when I speak of liberty, I'm referring to following the Constitution of the United States according to its original intent. That's how he judged the presidents. And guess who number 1 is? No, he's number 9. Who was the greatest president in Ivan Eland's opinion using the standard of peace, prosperity, and liberty? Did they follow the Constitution of the United States according to original intent? Who said John Tyler? Where?
State sovereignty, states' rights.
She knew the answer. Have you read the book?
No.
That's the right answer. John Tyler. Who in the world has ever heard of John Tyler? And Ivan Eland says, because of the record of what he chose to do, I have rated him number one. Now, we won't go through that giving you a book report. I'm just pointing out that we can learn, and we must learn how to evaluate our history. Stop raving and ranting about these pious humbugs who sent thousands of our best men off to die and be slaughtered. And start thinking about what did these people do to promote peace, prosperity, and liberty. And then we can start restoring liberty once again. The price of freedom is still eternal vigilance. I believe they attribute that to Thomas Jefferson. Read, read, read. The basic symbols of the American political tradition. Now, I didn't particularly enjoy the format, the English literature, the style of the authors, but I did enjoy their content. And I might point out they're both considered to be liberal political science professors. Does that make any difference? When you read a book, you say, I won't read this because it was written by a liberal. No, I'm a conservative. You don't even know what conservative means, or liberal. Well, these professors did a good job of pulling together some facts. And in their book, they have several things that we'll point out here for an examples. On page 19, myths are used to manipulate people. Now, there's a myth right now. It's the key myth for the Copenhagen Treaty. What is that myth? Climate change. You are responsible for changing the world's temperature, you rascals. That's a myth. And it's being used to manipulate people. On page 118, they talk about the Civil War derailment. The Civil War derailment derailed us, and we never got back what we lost. On page 10, they speak of the official literature written by the court historians. Now, the court historians are the ones that write the official literature for everyone to read and follow. This is the way it is, they say. And these professors point out that the way they say it is isn't necessarily the way it really is. But down on page 85... they have the big question. And the big question, they say, is, what shall we do? Your lectures are too long, Mr. Pratt. Just tell me what to do. And they say, we can't answer that. This is still coming from that same book. We can't answer what shall we do until we first answer two questions. Who and what are we as a people? Who are we? What did our founding fathers really do? And what has happened to it? The official literature is written by the politically correct court historians. We're going to give you four examples of it. Here's not the four, but these are just four current books. They just came out. Figuring out the founders. Four different authors decided they better write another book. Of the thousands and thousands of books about the founders, they had to write yet another book describing the founding fathers. What is history? If you look in the dictionary, you'll get definitions like these first two. This is right out of the dictionary. An account of what has happened. Okay. A second dictionary definition. The story accepted by the public. That's our history? Now, this third one is probably a more realistic definition. A college professor of history writes, history is evidence accompanied by reason and debate. Now we're getting closer to what history is. You cannot study the past, huh? You cannot study the past because it's gone. All you can study is the evidence of the past. Oh, yes. If you leave no evidence, there's nothing to study. Even though it really happened, there's nothing there to visual and see. Here's a definition coming from another college professor. His name was Ralph Reichel. He said, I asked my students, what is history? And one of the students responded, it's just one damn thing after another. Or maybe it's all of the above. Uh-oh, something terrible is happening just over the hill. It's out of sight. We can't see what's happening. But there is evidence that something terrible is happening. Oh, dear. Oh, it might be a hijacking. Now, when we think of hijacking, we usually think of some airplanes being routed off course and running into buildings. This is much worse than that. What we're about to show you is much worse than running airplanes into buildings and killing 3,000 people or so. It's hijacking our history. Now, that's the title of a Reader's Digest article in 1995, January issue if you want to read it. In 1995, they call it Hijacking Our History. Get a good summary of five or six pages telling how our history has been hijacked. and we are believing things that are not true. J. Reuben Clark, former Undersecretary of State, former ambassador to Mexico. This is back in the 30s, 20s and 30s. Greatest, probably one of the greatest scholars ever coming out of the state of Utah. Renowned lawyer. He was so renowned that when other lawyers would have a conference, they would ask J. Reuben Clark to be the speaker to speak to the lawyers. J. Reuben Clark once explained, "We are in the midst of the greatest propaganda campaign the world has ever known." He went on. Oops, I think I skipped a slide. Oh, yeah, must be another film I'm thinking of. "We are in the midst of the greatest propaganda campaign the world has ever known." That's quite a mouthful for a learned scholar, as he observed, as ambassador, undersecretary of state, and other leading positions. Let's give you three examples. This is example number one. The Manual of Citizenship Training, U.S. Government Printing Office, 1927. Now, when you read a book, they'll often quote in the book, like I told you, pouring from the different bottles, stirring it all together, and then giving you this new book. They'll quote this book and that book, and they'll say what Thomas Jefferson said and George Washington said, as if it's more credible because a famous man said it. What if a famous man says something false? Do you suppose they ever did? Does that make it true? No, it's still false. So I've slowed down. I haven't stopped yet, but I've slowed down quoting famous people. But just tell the truth and let the truth settle into your heart and let you discern whether it's true or not. I wanted to know, however, if it really said in the government training manual, I wanted to know if it was really there because it was such an astonishing thing that it said. In 1927, I read in a secondary source that the training manual said this: "The government of the United States is not a democracy, but a republic." Huh? That really said that? No, it couldn't have done that. We know it's a democracy. Don't we all? Everybody that knows it's a democracy, raise your hand. Oh, not too good audience here tonight. You go to the public school and try that, and everybody would raise their hand. That's what everybody knows, it's a democracy. I wanted to see if it really said that. And so I called my friend Tom Hinckley. He's a retired professor at BYU. I said, "Find me that book." Now, he's my research assistant. So a few weeks later, he calls back and says, It's in at the BYU Special Collections Library. Just go up there and sit down in the room there and read it. So I went to Special Collections. Boy, this is going to be exciting. I was going to see the real thing, not just a secondary source. And I remember that was a special occasion. I came up to the door, and the librarian greeted me with a smile. And she handed me an envelope. And she unlocked the door with a key. And I stepped through the door, and she closed it and locked it and took out the key. I'm serious, right up here on the hill. That's what they do to you. And then she sat by the window and watched me while I read this rare document, the Government Training Manual of 1927. Yes, this is secret information. I now know why they held it in such secrecy and such difficult to obtain, because I read this: the government of the United States is not a democracy. Don't let the secret out! But a republic. And then it went on. What are the principal characteristics of a democracy? Demagogism, license, impulse, agitation, discontent, anarchy, chaos, and socialism. That's democracy. Yes, that's what it said. But guess what? 25 years later, the government training manual says, because the United States is a democracy, the majority of the people decide how our government will be organized and run. The people do this by electing representatives, and these men and women then carry out the wishes of the people. Now, if that doesn't shake you in this history lesson tonight, nothing will. Last week, I finished this lesson, and a man came up at the end. David Miller was his name, in St. George.
That says Army Field Manual.
Yeah.
Well, the first one wasn't the Army Field Manual.
We'll go right back and show you what it was. The Manual of Citizenship Training of the U.S. Government Printing Office, sent out by the military, and I will show you the evidence. I will now. I'm about to spring one on you. This really, really. I got it last week. Here we are. This is the manual of 1952, and this student comes up, a student, I say, a person like you, and he says, I attended your lecture in Cedar City a year ago, and I was so intrigued about what you said about the primary sources. I decided I wanted to read it from a primary source, and I went online. And after several months, I located a copy of this rare book for sale. He paid a big price. And when the book arrived, that's the Army Training Manual or the Government Manual of 1927. When the book arrived, he opened it up, and guess what was inside? Oh, let's see if we can find it here. This was inside the manual. It fell out on the floor. A letter from the War Department, March the 2nd, 1938. I have your communication of February 27. Oh, this is from the War Department, written to a librarian named Duncan, Dinah Duncan, the librarian at the Legislative Reference Library in the state capital of Madison, Wisconsin. That's who it's to. She had written the War Department asking for an Army training manual for the library. And they wrote back and they said, I have your communication of February 26 with reference to obtaining a copy of the latest manual of citizenship training. In reply, you are advised that the manual of citizenship training of 1927, can you read what it says? Is obsolete. That's obsolete. That's how we do it in America. Yeah. It was true last year. It was true in 1927. Now it's obsolete. Something else is now true. Is that how truth works? No. Well, I just was absolutely astonished. I just saw that last week for the first time, that letter. Example number two. I shouldn't have to show any more examples. But that one, and now we'll just give you another one or two. I'm going to show you four. I used to use eight or ten, but it took too long. The Citizenship in the Nation Merit Badge Handbook. A few months ago, I was invited because they told me, we understand that you know all about the Constitution. Would you like to come speak to our adult leaders and tell them about citizenship in the nation? So I went to the Boy Scout Adult Leaders Group meeting, but not without being prepared. The night before the meeting, they came over and says, oh, by the way, you might want to read what our citizenship manual says. Well, that was very, very nice. The night before, I was supposed to sit down and read 35 pages of citizenship. Well, I didn't have to read very far. The second sentence was the first red flag, with 17 more red flags to follow. 18 in all red flags in the Boy Scout Citizenship Training Manual. Let me give you one of them. The second sentence says, the government the colonists established in the late 1700s has remained intact. Is that true?
No.
Well, now, just a minute. We all know it's intact. We still have a president. We still have the Supreme Court. Why, it's intact. Well, let me give you a contrasting viewpoint. Just like the Army training manuals, we're going to go to a man named Robert Bork. Robert Bork wrote excellent books, and thank you, Joe Ferguson, for sending me a long time ago The Tempting of America by Robert Bork. Good reading.
You're welcome. You never have paid me for it.
I thought it was a gift. About 35 years ago, that man invited me to come to a meeting much like this. And it wasn't nearly this nice, though, Joe. And this, it was just in somebody's backyard in an old beat-up room. And that changed my life. Thank you. Robert Bork, great scholar, great judge. Ronald Reagan nominated him for the Supreme Court. He went before the Senate committee. They interviewed him. And they asked him, what would you do if you became a justice of the Supreme Court? And he said, why, I would follow the Constitution according to the original intent. Was that the right thing to say? No. So then the enemies of the Constitution, and they're numerous, far, far abundant, more than the people who love it, they immediately raised $12 million, and they went through the routine and saw that he did not get the appointment. This is Robert Bork. Well, in 2003, he wrote the afterword to his book, Slouching Toward Gomorrah. Now, he's talking about America. slouching toward Gomorrah. Still good reading. And he says, the Constitution is simply gone. Now, that's after he has reviewed a court case known as Lawrence versus Texas. He says, if the Supreme Court can do what they did to the state of Texas, then there is no Constitution. At least it has no value. It is not being used. It is meaningless. Now, let's go back to the Boy Scouts again. What did they say in the Boy Scouts? Our government today is the same as it was in the 1700s. What does Robert Bork say? Our Constitution is gone. Are those in agreement with each other? No, they're absolutely opposed. Who's closest to the truth? Now let's try example number 3. This is a Utah history manual. Years ago, the publisher sent me a copy and asked me to read it for its content. I also read the 4th grade manual. This was for the 7th grade. I don't know. I doubt if they still use it. They probably have. It was in 1999. It came out. This is a wonderful man, I'm told. I don't know him personally. I'm just told that Dr. Holzapfel is a wonderful professor of history, a much beloved and a good, kind, decent man. And he writes this very kind, decent history, and in it, between pages 218 and 252, I've picked out some of the things that he teaches about Franklin Delano Roosevelt. This is what he teaches. Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal brought relief to millions. On December the 7th, 1941, there was a surprise attack on Pearl Harbor. Franklin Roosevelt's fireside chats kept the people informed of the war's progress. Franklin Roosevelt was a great man of peace. Now, this is the summary coming from the 7th grade history book used for a long time, I presume, may still be in use, in the state of Utah. Now let me contrast that to another scholar. I hold this other scholar in high respect also. Just because I respect them doesn't mean they're right or wrong. But this scholar's name is Alan Stang. On February the 1st, 2008, on newswithviews.com, Alan Stang wrote, speaking about the same man, liar, swindler, thief, traitor, and mass murderer, Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Now, these are both supposed to be historical reports. Which one's closest to the truth?
Alan Stang.
I'll let you decide. Okay? Some things are true whether you believe it or not. Now, that was on a billboard coming into town. I saw it down there by Payson. Some things are true whether you believe it or not. I gave a presentation in Idaho one time, and an old, wrinkled, farmer-looking person, you know, he must have been a farmer, he was gray and weathered, he came up and he was livid with anger. He put his finger under my nose about this far from me, and he shook it back and forth. I want you to know, young man, that Franklin Delano Roosevelt was the greatest president that ever lived. Who's telling the truth? Let's try the next example. This is more fun than an example. This is a rest break right here. A picture is worth 1,000 words, okay? There's 1,000 words of history. Just let that represent 1,000 words of written history. It doesn't matter what subject it's on. Just 1,000 words of written history. Is it true? What is it? If that's 1,000 words of history and you just finished reading it, and you have never read any other history, and that's it. Is it true? Is that picture 1,000? Is that true? You don't even know what it is, do you? Oh, it's a printing press. Well, you know, I don't want to brag or anything. I mean, I don't want to puff myself up in arrogance and pride or anything like that. But I just happen to be knowledgeable on printing presses. And that is an abomination. It's a disgusting presentation of a printing press. It would never work. It's a piece of junk. It's not worthy of being called a printing press. Huh? But it's history. It's 1,000 words of history. And that's the way much history is written, as I've given you examples to prove it. Now let me show you why this is a disgusting illustration of history. This this printing press, it's a little explanation here. This man, the printer, is pulling on this bar, and he's twisting this screw, and he's pushing a block of wood down against some type that's on a stone. The stone might be 3 inches thick and 18 inches wide and 2 feet long. Just the stone itself is very heavy, and then there's an inch layer of type on top of the stone, and then you have the sand in which the stone is bedded, and you have a wooden box called the coffin that holds the stone. You can see all this down at the Crandall Historic Printing Museum. Lewis Crandall's here tonight. And now he's done printing the page, and what's he going to do with this big stone and the type and all? He has to somehow get it out from under the press, but there's nowhere to put it. This is what's missing, the carriage. There's supposed to be a great big strong table right here with tracks on it, and that slides out onto the table, but there is not one. It's missing. Let's try the second part of this disgusting picture. Right here. This is called, this screw is supposed to have a till. Now the till, it's not there, it's missing. The till is made up of two big blocks of wood that go around that square portion right there on the screw, and it stops the screw from twisting the platen, which is pushing on the type. It converts rotary motion into linear motion. It's missing. It won't work without a till. But that's not all. It even gets worse. This is the screw. Look at the threads on the screw. It's all screwed up. It's backwards. Now, this is how history is written. Am I too harsh on historians? I've given you three illustrations of historians who claim to be great historians, and they've done an abomination of writing the history. This screw is false. Now, we're going to give you some illustrations here. This picture represents the story accepted by the public. Remember that definition from the dictionary? This is history. This is the story of it. We all know that's a printing press. We all know that's correct history. With its missing carriage and its missing till, those together historians call historical blackout. Missing parts in history. Why did John McManus leave out the story of the First Bank of the United States? Why did he leave it out? You read his answer. That's history we'll have to leave for another time. He was afraid of the cognitive dissonance it would cause. Historical blackout. This screw is false propaganda. It's just plain false. Now you couple those two together and you get historical brainwashing. Let's take an example, this missing carriage. We're going to talk about some missing history that most Americans know nothing about. I just picked out a subject that I thought would be, you're an unusual audience, but I have a hunch that if I called upon you, anybody in here want to stand up and give a 5-minute oration on the gigantic faction of 1861? A huge faction that changed the entire course of the United States. And most people have never heard of it before. They don't even know what I'm talking about. That's why I'm calling about blackout. It's been blacked out of the books. It is not in the story told. Here are some of the books on the gigantic faction. These are the first 17 that I read. I mean, I scoured them. I became desirous of knowing what happened. Why was I deprived of the history? Why was it blacked out in my life and that I was never taught what happened in this gigantic faction of 1861? And after I read those 17, I read 12 more. That's 29 books carefully reviewing and studying the faction of 1861. It's like a puzzle. As you start reading, you start piecing the puzzle together. It starts becoming clear what happened. No one author has it all together. But if you work at it long enough, I'm of the opinion that you can gain a picture, an understanding of what happened in the past. Here's an example of one of those books, 1862. I believe, as I recall, James Spence was a lawyer living in England. He wrote about America from England. And he wrote this book, The American Union. In 1862, he wrote, "At the present day, we search in vain for one single name that may be termed that of a statesman. Politicians cover the land. Statesmen seem to have become extinct. That was the problem in 1862. What's the problem now? Have we improved? In 1863, Abel Parker Upshur was Undersecretary of State. He was a highly respected attorney prior to that. He took Daniel Webster's place when Daniel Webster stepped down. Abel Parker Upshur's title should tell you something. The true nature and character of our federal government. A critical review of Joseph Story's commentaries on the Constitution. Now we're going to deal with Joseph Story in the second lesson this evening. So, the true nature? You mean there's a false nature? Yeah. There's a false nature, and that's the one most of us have been hearing all of our lives. It's that nonsense about Franklin Roosevelt we saw in the Utah history book. That kind of thing misleads us. This 1878 book is one of my favorites. Now, there are several of these on the table. It's 550 pages. It does have some illustrations in it. It's well written. And it was one of the best books that I read on the gigantic faction. What he does is takes 100 years of American history and puts it into 550 pages and does a great job. Bernard Jannan Sage, I wish I had time to tell you about him. He was a great scholar. I just had to bite my tongue not to give the stories. George Edmund's name was really Elizabeth Meriwether. When Elizabeth wrote this book, it was not popular for a woman to write and expect people to respect what she wrote, so she had to put a man's name on the book. She quotes here from a general from the Union Army. He wrote in 1887, "The true story of the late war has not been told. It probably never will be told. It is not flattering to our people. Unpalatable truths seldom find their way into history." Here's another one from 1907. Albert Taylor Bledsoe writes in the introduction, he himself being a college professor in that day, a mathematics professor. He writes in the introduction, "I just want my children and grandchildren to know what the truth is about this past conflict in America." And then he launches into it. Now we're back to the press again. That was an example of the historical blackout, as we have not been told the story that I just summarized. Here we have the missing till. These blocks that are not here. They're just not there. They're gone. They're blacked out. Let's let the missing till represent the great gold heist of 1933. Again, you're an unusual audience, so there are probably several in here that could give me an explanation of this. But the general run-of-the-mill people out on the street, they don't know what we're talking about. This was the biggest gold robbery in the history of the world. 700 million ounces of gold were confiscated. Wow, shouldn't our children know about that? Shouldn't we be taught about that? It affected our entire economy. It affected all the history since then. Well, it was blacked out. Just a couple of fun pictures from that robbery. Here some of the robbers are. Yes. They're taking the gold, putting it in boxes, and shipping it off to a place no one will ever see it again. Who are these people? Oh, these are just the peon employees hired by the big boss, the ringleader, the mafia gangster. If I was to pick 8 words that started with P and describe this past president, now I have 10 words. The past president, perpetual prevaricator, philanderer, plus power-piling pompous politician. That's 10 words starting with P that describe this man. I always thought it was 8, but I got the 2 more. Past president. This was the rogue that launched the great gold heist. You can learn about it in various publications. It's readily available information. It's no secret, but you have to apply yourself and read. This is a great reading right here. This is a great reading. I really like this one. Good author, good style. Okay, now let's go to the screw that's false. False propaganda. The supreme fraud of 1945. Now, if you thought of all the evil things that happened in the past in American history, but you wanted to focus on one of the worst. Go to the year 1945, and I am going to show you a photograph of the supreme fraud of 1945. Get ready for cognitive dissonance to set in. That's it. Huh? That a fraud? That was a fraud? No, Mr. Pratt, you're mistaken. The United Nations Charter is one of the greatest documents of freedom ever written. All of our public schools praise and honor it. Little children are told to love the United Nations. They have mock United Nations celebrations. They're all told about the great movement now to have the Copenhagen Treaty. That's a United Nations program. Huh? Let me ask a few key questions, if you can come back out of your emotional stress long enough to handle them. Who were the chief architects of the United Nations Charter? If the charter was all that great, who wrote it? Is that fair to ask? And second, what were their goals? Now, I'm not going to give you the story. I know you can't ask questions or raise your hand. Here's one of them right here. This is Alger Hiss, the first Secretary General of the United Nations. 3 years later, he was taken before an investigating committee, and it was determined that he was a communist. He was our chief diplomat. He, along with 17 other diplomats, were also later discovered to be communist or communist affiliates. That was the American contingency of diplomats that we sent. That wasn't all of them, but that was enough. 17 supporters of an alien and foreign doctrine. They were the authors from the United States, but that's not all. Other countries sent their ambassadors to San Francisco to write the communist doctrines into the United Nations Charter. Who's this? Uncle Joe Stalin. Uncle Joe. That was the affectionate name that FDR gave him. Uncle Joe. Uncle Joe, if there was a Guinness Book of World Records, what would his record be? Yeah, he was the biggest mass murderer in the history of the world. And he was our ally. He was Franklin Roosevelt's ally. And who is he sending now to the delegation at San Francisco to write the Charter of the United Nations? V.M. Molotov, one of his top murderous henchmen, and his cronies. Now, have I given you enough? Is it now time to raise a red flag and say, maybe the United Nations was a fraud? Maybe. Oh, no. Just because these authors were all on the wrong side of the fence supporting alien doctrine, certainly that doesn't mean the document's a fraud, does it? You decide. There is an excellent talk, Two Contending Forces, by Herb Titus. He spoke at the dinner. I spoke at the luncheon in Cincinnati, Ohio, 3 years ago. I first met him then. His talk was so good, I got his permission to put it on my website. You can read the talk, contrasting the Charter of the United Nations to the Constitution of the United States. It does a beautiful job. 7 pages of single-spaced typing with no pictures. Here's a better drawing. This is another ancient drawing from the old days showing a printing press. They have the wonderful carriage in this one. This place in this orange box, right? This is the carriage. They have the till. These big blocks of wood on both sides of the screw. They hold the screw so it doesn't twist. And here is the cherub in front of the screw. But look at the screw. Do a close-up on it now. What do you see? It's backwards. It's still backwards. It's still false. But notice the cherub in front of the screw. Now, this is how some of the false doctrines are handled in writing history and books. This is a sweet little cherub with the little wings hiding the screw. False propaganda, historical whitewashing. These are terms used to describe this kind of history. If I were a dictatorial president of the United States, I would declare by executive order, all history books must have a warning on the cover. You know, like cigarettes do. All history books must say, warning, when studying history, look for the cherub in front of the screw. So what is this smooth talk from the professionals doing to us? What is the smooth talk doing from the prominent men and women that distort history? How is it affecting and influencing us? Here's some smooth talk. This is the cherub in front of the screw. In the year 2005, House Resolution 2745 was promoted, asking the United States to give more support, more money, more everything to the United Nations, because the United Nations is created to prevent war, protect human rights, and advance the cause of human freedom. That was the presentation before the United States Congress. That is the cherub in front of the screw. Here's a wonderful picture of a printing press. I like old printing history. It's one of my favorites. And this one here is well done. There's not much wrong I can find in it. Pretty good. Even like the dog down in front there. The artist has presented this historical evidence in such a beautiful and neat manner. All of the implements on the floor represent different parts of the press, and they've labeled them so that you can see where they fit into the press. A nice job. And I would call this the bare naked truth. Okay? That's just it. You did a good job. And there's even a symbol for that. I like this symbol. Do you know what fairy tale this represents? Remember Hans Christian Andersen? Remember the fairy tale, The Emperor Has No Clothes? Well, that's the illustrations from one of the children's books. And I thought that's a good symbol for a book that tells the bare naked truth. Example number 4. This is the last one, then we're going to take a break. I have on the book, or on the table in front of me, 2 books. These 2 books right here. I'm going to read you a story. I'm going to start with the newest book. This was, again, I don't know if they're still in use in Utah, but at one time they were, both of them. This book right here, Secrets and Surprises. And I'm going to read to you a story. I'm contrasting the 2 contending forces. Rachel's birthday party. Rachel had planned her party since last Friday. Her friends arrived early. She greeted each one with a broad smile. She received her presents at the door. She liked the African plant her best friend gave her. Then they all sat down. Rachel's father was going to entertain them. He did magic tricks. He forced a rabbit to stand up. Then he made Rachel's mother float in the air. She was level with the top of the table. She remained in the air for a whole minute. Everyone had a good time. Now that's a second grade reader in the state of Utah. All of the stories in the book are comparable in quality to that one. Any story you want to go to, you'll find that same kind of quality. This is designed to teach the little children reading and writing and spelling and grammar. And what else does it teach them? Trivia and nonsense and witchcraft. What power did this father use to make Rachel's mother float in the air for a minute? Does anybody want to know? I want you to hear that one first because I'd like to leave on a happy note. We'll leave for the break, that is. We're going to go back to 1920 when my father was a little boy in school. And 2 of my sisters are here tonight. And he says, we studied McGuffey readers. And we're going to read a story from McGuffey. Every story in McGuffey has equal quality to the sample that I'm giving you. This story is called Henry the Bootblack. Henry was a kind, good boy. His father was dead and his mother was very poor. He had a little sister about 2 years old. He wanted to help his mother, for she could not always earn enough to buy food for her little family. One day, a man gave him $1 for finding a pocketbook which he had lost. Henry might have kept all the money, for no one saw him when he found it. But his mother had taught him to be honest and never to keep what did not belong to him. With the $1, he bought a box, 3 brushes, and some blacking. He then went to the corner of the street, and he said to everyone whose boots did not look nice, "Black your boots, sir, please." He was so polite that gentlemen soon began to notice him and to let him black their boots. The first day he brought home 50 cents, which he gave to his mother to buy food. When he gave her the money, She said as she dropped a tear of joy, "You are a dear good boy, Henry. I did not know how I could earn enough to buy bread, but now I think we can manage to get along quite well." Which way would you like your children to learn English, spelling, punctuation, and grammar? I have given you 4 examples, and there are hundreds more. You can find them for yourself. If people train themselves to find them, they can find them for themselves. You must be looking for them. The contrasting powers, 2 contending forces. If a nation expects to be ignorant and free, it expects what never was and never will be. We must overcome the region of ignorance. Do you remember the little child was standing on the sideline? And when the king went by, the emperor that is, with no clothes, what did Hans Christian Andersen have the little child say? "The emperor has no clothes." Isn't that a unique thought? Tell the truth. The emperor has no clothes. And the people along the sidelines heard it. She was just talking to her father, but they heard it and they started passing it along. I heard a little child say, "The emperor has no clothes." And that's what we need to do with our history. We need to start speaking out and telling the truth. Not being silent, but in kindness and gentleness and love, just tell the truth. Share it in the written form if you haven't got time or they don't have time to hear the story verbally. Hand them something. For example, we have distributed about 3 million copies of the Constitution in the last 2 years. 3 million. I had one here, but I've distributed it. You want to carry them with you wherever you go. Buy 10 or 15 or 20 tonight. They're 50 cents a piece. Don't buy them. I'll give them to you if you want. If I thought you would hand them out effectively, you can have as many as you can carry tonight as I've got there. Because I'm enthused about using that as a handout. The little booklet, the Constitution. If you're able to donate, donate something for the use of them. Put them in your pocket. Walk around with them. Go to the restaurant. Kind of leave your coat back like this. You know, and you'll be amazed at how many good responses you get as you try to find ways to share the story of liberty with your friends and foreigners, people who don't even know you. Expose the bare naked truth. Now, if I could get this little girl to say something, I would have her say this: "He who does not read is no better off than he who cannot read." Here's a good place to start. I finished this lesson last week, and one of my friends, I called on the phone the next day, a woman, and I said, what did you think of that? She said, "I enjoyed the evening, but so much of it was just over my head." And I had another experience similar to that, an 18-year-old, my grandson, a wonderful young man. And he got done with one evening's lesson like this, and he said, "Grandpa, I didn't understand a thing you said." Now, I do not know what the case is there. Why? Here I had this 51-year-old woman and an 18-year-old young man. Neither of them seemed to grasp what I was trying to present. I wonder if maybe they're so far behind that I got too far ahead. Does that make any sense? This book is not too far ahead. I think it was like 25 years ago when I helped and worked on this publication. I wrote the foreword for the recent edition. I was thrilled in March when we had national number one bestseller status for about 2 weeks. That was a great experience for us, as this basic concepts of American history were taught to the people. There's nothing objectionable in here. I don't think anyone would be offended by any of the concepts. They're presented in a kind and gentle and loving way. And I just love computers because if we would read and follow these concepts, the sun would rise on America again. Now, I don't like the name of this lesson. It needs a new name. I tried thinking of a better name, and I thought it could be titled "When We Were Sleeping" or "While We Were Sleeping." But actually, it's "While Generations Before Us Were Sleeping," and we're sleeping too. And so I'm still struggling with the proper title for this lesson. Federalist, anti-federalist just doesn't turn me on. Now, sovereignty is getting close to a turn-on word, but most people don't have a clue as to what that means. "I'll give you a little of my sovereignty, and then we can both share it." Is that a nice idea? Okay. Well, we're going to start with the current picture and a couple of current events, and then we'll go back into the old history. A presidency fit for a king. There are numerous quotations we could give you. Just give a few. The United States government will resume its role in globally funding abortions. Now, he announced that, I think it was 3 days after he went into office. We will double taxes by the year 2018. We will double the national debt by 2019 to more than $23 trillion. I think that's already doubled from there. June 2009 is Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, and Transgender Pride Month. These are the kinds of things coming forth from the executive branch of our government. Now, people say, oh, if we could just go back to Ronald Reagan, everything would be okay again. Oh, if we could just go back to before Franklin Roosevelt botched it all up, everything would be okay again. Oh, they say, if we could just go back to before 1913 with the triple whammy, everything would be okay again. The triple whammy was the 16th Amendment, the 17th Amendment, and the Federal Reserve System. That's the triple whammy of 1913. If we could just go back, that's when the whole card deck of cards collapsed. If we could just go back before Eve partook of the forbidden fruit, everything would be okay again. There are two contending forces. It will always be that way on this mortal earth. We want to be sure we're on the right side. We might even be able to learn something from the movies. Now, I didn't go to this movie. I read about it, and then I went to the got a friend to go to the website and get me these pictures. I don't go to movies. That's not my thing. But I heard there was a Batman movie. And I read it in an article, and the guy said there was a lady named Rachel Dawes and a man named Bruce Wayne, and they were up on top of this building, and they were looking down. Down in the city below, there was crime and corruption. And Rachel Dawes says to Bruce Wayne, "It's not what you feel inside that counts. It's what you do that defines you." And Bruce Wayne dove off the building. And as he went down, Rachel could hear him muttering under his breath, "It's what you do that defines you." Now, here's a man that's doing something in Oklahoma. His name is Charles Key. This was the state where they began taking on the feds. He is a member of the state legislature. He was instrumental in, and by the way, notice the date. This was news on March the 30th, 2009. He was instrumental in taking a 10th Amendment resolution through the legislature and seeing it passed in Oklahoma. An amendment that says, we demand that, well, I'll just read it directly. This is out of that resolution. All of us have taken an oath, or it's out of his quotation about the resolution. All of us have taken an oath to uphold the Constitution. And the Constitution either means what it says, or it means nothing. State sovereignty movement is what they call this in Oklahoma, or the 10th Amendment movement. Now, the 10th Amendment Center is the website. You can go to that website, and you can see what they're doing across the country. It started in Oklahoma on March the 30th, 2009. In that resolution, they said, "This serves as notice and demand to the federal government as our agent to cease and desist, effective immediately, mandates that are beyond the scope of the constitutionally delegated powers." Wouldn't that be something? Yeah. That's not just a bunch of radical nuts. That's the Oklahoma State Legislature passed this resolution, and they passed it with a good margin. This is a man in the Senate, the Oklahoma Senate. Randy Brogdon, I believe, is his name. He's standing here with some of his supporters. And Randy Brogdon says, "The state of Oklahoma hereby claims," this is not him speaking, this is out of the resolution, "The state of Oklahoma hereby claims sovereignty under the 10th Amendment to the Constitution of the United States." Wow! This is a sleeping giant being aroused. It passed 83-13 in the House and 25 to 17 in the Senate. Now, this is exciting news. Newsflash, June the 8th, 2009. Montana state legislature and governor defy the feds. And this one, again, if you're up on the news, you already know this one, but in Montana, the legislature passed and the governor signed a bill, a law, saying that they no longer would mess around with the BATF, and the BATF had no jurisdiction over guns they manufactured in the state as long as they put made in Montana and kept them within the state. Now, they're testing. They're testing the federal government. They're declaring in this law sovereignty once again. Newsflash, June the 29th, 2009. This was a letter to the editor, as I recall. One thing not reported by the media about the recent Republican state convention was the passing of Resolution 3. We voted for the Republican Party to take any and all steps necessary to ensure that federal powers exercised within the great state of Utah not exceed those granted by the Constitution of the United States, thus protecting Utah state sovereignty. Sherry Ramirez was the author of that summary. Now, some of you were there at that state convention. Now, these are some samples of what's going on. Yahoo Mail! My friend sent it in the snail mail. I got a Yahoo snail mail. November the 7th, 2009. Now, we're getting closer here. State Sovereignty Resolutions and Nullification Acts. The 10th Amendment Center, an organization seeking to promote the original concept of state sovereignty. Now, that's all the further I'm going to go on that, because that's what we're going to talk about now. We're going to talk about the original concept of state sovereignty. Most people don't even know what it's talking about. What is this anyway, this thing called sovereignty? We're going to show you the two contending forces from the very beginning. Now, state sovereignty resolutions as of October 2009. Resolutions have been introduced in the legislatures of 37 states. In 7 states, the resolutions passed. Alaska, Idaho, North Dakota, South Dakota, Oklahoma, Louisiana, and Tennessee have passed state sovereignty resolutions. Oh, what did he say? It's what you do that defines you. Now, those states are doing something. Why isn't Utah's name up there yet? Well, we'll try again. We're not done. But we will put Utah on there as a state that supports state sovereignty. The 5,000-year leap, the 10th principle, the God-given right to govern, is vested in the sovereign authority of the whole people. That's a fundamental doctrine of liberty. And if we would follow that, the sun would rise in America once again. A people must, from time to time, refresh themselves at the wellspring of their origin, lest they perish. Read, read, read. One old socialist named George Bernard Shaw, a socialist in the Fabian movement in England many years ago, in the movement they call gradualism, where they would not impose socialism by force like they did in the Bolshevik Revolution of 1917, where they forced the people to embrace socialism. He says, we're going to do it gradually, just a little at a time. And he says, the only weapon we will use is words, words, words. So read, read, read. And let's try and sort out the words, words, words. This little book, I enjoyed it. The man writes, Walter Neal, he says, this is an oration. An oration. It's just a speech, with other words. 150 pages. You think I speak a long time. And there are no pictures. The Sovereignty of the States is the title. He gave the oration in 1910 on the graveside in Manassas, the first and a later battle in the Civil War. In this book, he points out, in wresting the power, or what is called the sovereignty, from the crown, it passed directly to the people. Now, he gave a history talking about the colonies before we became free, independent states. And under the leadership of the King of England, there were 13 kingdoms in America. 13 separate, distinct kingdoms, and they all shared the same king. And when we declared our independence, that's what he's speaking about, in wresting the power, or what is called the sovereignty, from the crown, it passed directly to the people. Now, let's try to build that one up. It passed directly to the people of each colony, and not to the people of all the colonies in the aggregate, to 13 distinct communities. This is a very key point. 13 distinct communities, and not to one. You see, the two contending forces we'll introduce soon. They say, oh, no, that's not what happened. We became one great nation, one great union. And the sovereignty was to the nation, and then they started setting, oh, just a minute now. What really happened? What is the evidence? Is Davis a traitor? I really enjoy Albert Taylor Bledsoe. I hope to meet him someday. In 1907, he wrote, ever since the Declaration of Independence, there have been two great political parties in the United States. These two contending forces, he points out, are, one believes the states are districts of people composing one political society. The American people form one consolidated nation. Now that's the one contending force. And these are the two political parties that have existed ever since when? Ever since the Declaration of Independence. There have been two contending forces. And the one contends the states are districts of people composing one political society, and the other contends the states were free, sovereign, independent, and maintained this status even after creating and ratifying the Constitution. That's the other force. Well, summarized in shorter words, one of the two contending forces says sovereignty of the national government, and the other force says sovereignty of the individual states. They cannot both be sovereign at the same time. And they cannot divide their sovereignty. It is absolutely impossible. I have a lady that came up after one of the lessons like this. She was absolutely unhappy with me. She says, it's divided sovereignty. We all know that. The states have some and the federal government has some and it's divided. Let me show you the evidence and then you decide if you can divide it or not. You be the judge. Let's go to the dictionary in 1828. Now, we want to use the words as they were used in the day that they were written. So if we want to know the meaning of sovereignty in 1828 or in 1754, it's the same meaning, by the way, we go to the dictionaries at that time period. Sovereign, supreme in power, the possession of the highest power. The Republic of Republics in 1878 wrote, Republican sovereignty. The people are the fountain of all power. They must, however, delegate it to agents because they cannot exercise it in person. All power was wrested from the king and it went to the people. The people of separate, distinct colonies. And then they became states. But they exercise their sovereignty through their state organization. In the Republican principle, they have delegates, and those delegates come together, and they work for and in behalf of their constituents, the people who have delegated them the power to do that. They get comfortable with this. Work it through so you can talk to your friends about it. John Taylor of Caroline. They always said John Taylor of Caroline to distinguish him from other John Taylors. John Taylor of Caroline was a great scholar of that time period, 1823. He wrote a book called New Views of the Constitution of the United States. Now, he's a man that you have probably never heard of before. How many have heard of John Taylor of Caroline? Not even Lowell? I tell you, I lucked out tonight. John Taylor of Caroline was a fine scholar. In 1823, some of the notes of the Federal Convention were made available that hadn't been available prior to that. They were the notes written by a man, I believe his name was Yeats. And when Yeats's notes came out, it made it possible to get better insight into what happened at the Federal Convention. Ah, so John Taylor of Caroline writes some new views. new meaning that new information has been presented as to how the debates went at the Federal Convention. So new views of the Constitution of the United States. Published it, widely respected author, great, great scholar. We'll learn more about him in a moment. The Constitution was thus a compact among the states, resting on the sovereignty of the people as expressed through their state conventions. Now, when you leave tonight, I hope nobody can buffalo you. They can't give you the contending force that's on the wrong side, the dark side. The Constitution was thus a compact among the states, resting on the sovereignty of the people as expressed through their state conventions. James Madison, our government system is established by compact, not between the government of the United States and the state governments. It's not a compact between the United States government and the state governments. That's not that. How can I jump up and down enough to get you clear? It's not. What is it? It's between the states as sovereign communities. And that is very different than a contract with the federal government. See, when Utah entered the Union, they wrote in their constitution that they would never be able to separate again. That was it. We'll never separate. We pledge that we will always be indivisible. That was never the intention of the Founding Fathers. It is a contract between sovereign communities. Abraham Lincoln defined sovereignty in his speech to Congress, July the 4th, 1861. He said, sovereignty is a political community without a superior. Now, is that a valid definition for sovereignty? Here's Daniel Webster. Or excuse me, not Daniel, Noah Webster. Don't get them confused. A political community without a superior. Noah Webster, the great dictionary author, supreme in power, the possession of the highest power. So is a political community without a superior in possession of the highest power? Come on, commit yourselves. Yeah, those are harmonious definitions. However, then Abraham Lincoln turned right around in the same speech and declared, no one of our states except Texas ever was a sovereignty, and even Texas gave up the character on coming into the Union. Did the states give up their sovereignty when they joined the Union? Absolutely not. The Union is older than any of the states, and in fact, it created them as states. This is the 1861 L word. I didn't use the L word, but I heard it in the audience. Remember, there are two contending forces. One believes the sovereignty of the national government. The other believes the sovereignty of the individual states. Webster's New World Dictionary of 1957. I might add, it's the only book I bought when I went to the university that was worth keeping. I still have it. Sovereign, above or superior to all others. Chief, greatest, supreme. Independent of all others, as a sovereign state. Now, that's still a definition that harmonizes with Noah Webster's 1828 dictionary. From the Federalist Papers. We also should learn from the Anti-Federalist Papers. Huh? Most people have never heard of the Anti-Federalist Papers. The side that wins the war writes the history. And the side that won the war and directed the course of the nation hasn't said a whole lot about the content of the Anti-Federalist Papers. I had brought a whole bunch of copies. They're on the back table, and you can be one of the few Americans that can start informing yourself. Who are the Anti-Federalists? Can you name one of the most famous ones? You probably can. Who was a famous Anti-Federalist? Thank you, Patrick Henry. He was probably one of the most outstanding statesmen of the day. A tremendous American, a great, great hero. And yet, what doctrines of Patrick Henry do we hear? Give me liberty or give me death, but we don't hear that much anymore. Okay, these two were contending forces. Now, we're not saying the one is good and the other evil. I'm just pointing out that in this case, there were two disagreeing groups. The Federalist Papers has been held up and lauded as this marvelous document defining the Constitution, this great presentation. Well, not everybody believed that, then or now. Alexander Hamilton was one of the key authors of the Federalist Papers. The basic ideas of Alexander Hamilton, written in 1956, compiled by Richard Morris, was helpful and very enlightening as I grasped better the significance of this founding father. Hamilton's plan. He presented this plan in June of 1787. He stood before the Constitutional Convention and declared, "We should centralize power in the national government with full sovereignty." That means the national government will have all the power to control, regulate, and run the states. The chief executive and senators to serve during good behavior. That means for life. The chief executive to have absolute veto power. How would you like that if Barack Obama had absolute veto power? Veto anything the legislature did. Oh, but that's not the end of it. The central government would appoint state governors with absolute veto power over the laws passed by their respective state legislatures. Yeah, we have a king. It's a monarchy. That's what Hamilton wanted, was a monarchy. Well, he wasn't well received because that was not the intention of the general body of thinkers there. He and the other delegates from New York were upset that their ideas weren't accepted, and so they all went home during the convention. And Hamilton was the only one that came back. On page 130 of this Basic Ideas of Alexander Hamilton, September the 6th, 1787, James Madison is taking notes about the Federal Convention. Now, his notes are considered the most useful and famous notes of the Federal Convention. And in his notes he writes, "Mr. Hamilton disliked the proposed scheme of government, but meant to support the plan as better than nothing." Now, this is the author of the Federalist Papers. He's supposed to be defending the Constitution's original intent, and he doesn't even like it. Oh, but it's better than nothing. September the 17th, 1787, the delegates come up. They sign the document. Hamilton signs it also. It's better than nothing. Now, the sentiment in the country was hostile to a national government and preferred a confederation or federation. The words were then synonymous. By a clever move, the proponents of the proposed Constitution called themselves the Federalists. Hence, we had the Federalist Papers. They were the people that wanted the proposed Constitution to pass. That was regretful, but they chose the name Federalist. It was a good advertising ploy. So here we have the Federalist Papers. These three authors are trying to convince the people in the delegation in the state of New York that the Constitution would be good. They should accept it. It is a special pleading for the Constitution, or this book is a special pleading for the Constitution before it's ratified. They're hoping the New York delegation will ratify it. It is a supposed neutrality. How in the world can you say it's neutral if all three of these men are Federalists? It is a supposed neutrality in explaining the meaning of the Constitution. And Justice Story, who was a nationalist consolidationist, would later use his commentaries on the law and would base them, write them, around the Federalist Papers. Now, this is all history that most people have never paid any attention to. Publius was the name under which they published, and for some time no one knew just who was writing the papers. Thomas Jefferson was in France as our ambassador, and someone sent him the papers, as it was first newspaper articles. Someone sent these letters or these papers to Thomas Jefferson. He was a great scholar and a great student of government, and he wrote back a letter to James Madison on November 1788. He praised the Federalist as the best commentary on the principles of government which ever was written. Now, definitely a high compliment. Great commentary on the principles of good government. But he went on to observe, "In some parts it is discoverable that the author means only to say what may be best said in defense of opinions in which he did not concur." Whoever's writing these papers, Thomas Jefferson says, obviously doesn't believe what he's saying. Who could that have been? This divides the book up into who wrote the most. Alexander Hamilton wrote 2/3, James Madison about 1/3, and a tiny amount. This man was not well. He wasn't able to participate too much. John Jay. The Federalist Papers were written by Federalists to convince the Anti-Federalist in the state of New York that it would be safe to ratify the proposed Constitution. Hamilton certainly did not like the plan, but thought it would be better than nothing. The delegates elected to the New York Ratifying Convention were largely Anti-Federalist. And then it gives us the number down here. 46 were Anti-Federalist and 19 were Federalist. So Hamilton has a job to carry out. He's got to convince 46 people that don't agree, that don't want, because they feel the Constitution will be too consolidated. He's got to convince them that it's a safe plan and it won't be a consolidated government, even though that's what he wants. Now, the Anti-Federalist. They were the foes of ratification because they believed it would bring too much consolidation. The foes of ratification were left with the negative designation, Anti-Federalist. They sought a society where virtuous, hard-working, honest men and women lived simply in their own communities, enjoyed their families and their neighbors, were devoted to the common welfare, and had such churches, schools, trade associations, and local governments as they needed to sustain their values and purposes. That doesn't sound all bad, does it? This was the feeling, the sentiment of this group of thinkers. They believed that the end of good government is the protection of life, liberty, and property. Any other function is usurpation and oppression. That didn't sound so bad to me. Yeah, these were the Anti-Federalists. Their greatest fear, the proposed Constitution would be construed to create a great, splendid, consolidated government and universal empire. And that's where we are today. A great, splendid, consolidated government and world empire. Patrick Henry being one of the most competent and greatest statesmen of that time period, an Anti-Federalist. Those nations who have gone in search of grandeur, power, and splendor have also fallen a sacrifice and been the victims of their own folly. While they acquired those visionary blessings, they lost their freedom. The first thing I have at heart is American liberty. Maintain free, sovereign, independent states. Give me liberty, or give me death. That was the sentiment of the great Anti-Federalist, Patrick Henry. Alexander Hamilton, in contrasting the two viewpoints, declared, "The people seldom judge or determine right. Give, therefore, to the first class a distinct permanent share in the government." People are too stupid to govern themselves. Let's get the aristocracy to govern us. This is Hamilton. He was a consolidationist, a nationalist. These are terms that refer to the kind of thinking that he believed in. He believed in enumerated powers plus implied powers. Didn't matter if the power was there or not. If you needed, you know, anything in the general welfare to help, you know, America would be okay. That's called an implied power. You had no power to do it, but you just took it anyway. He wanted a Bank of the United States. Oh, John McManus. I wrote him 2 pages suggesting how he could handle Hamilton. And all I got back was the statement that says, "That's American history we'll have to deal with later." Probably good wisdom on his part. Blessing of a national debt. Hamilton wanted a national debt, and one author that admires Hamilton decided to write a book. And it's called Hamilton's Blessing. And it's about the national debt, written 10 years ago. Another author that doesn't admire Hamilton just wrote a book last year called Hamilton's Curse, in answer to Hamilton's Blessing. Am I serious? I've studied them both carefully. Non-uniform excise taxes, a standing army, protective tariffs, growing power of the president, and growing power of the judiciary. These are all goals of Alexander Hamilton, a consolidationist nationalist. In this little book, The Sovereignty of the States, we read, Alexander Hamilton begat the Federal Party. The Federal Party begat the Whig Party. The Whig Party begat the Republican Party. This is the genealogy of today's Republican Party. Yeah, you're descendants of you. There's probably not a Democrat in here. You're descendants of Alexander Hamilton. He didn't even know it. Wendell Phillips, a Republican senator, he declared, "The Republican Party is in no sense a national party. It is a party of the North organized against the South." The gigantic faction by 1861 was the Republican Party. Hamilton's sole object was to create a government outside the federal constitution. And today, in 1910, that is the chief object of the Republican Party. Now, that was the observation of a scholar in the year 1910. If I were the person writing Alexander Hamilton's epitaph, this is what I would write on his tombstone. Father of constitutional subversion and the most famous nationalist in American history. Now, I have angered people by treating this founding father in this manner. May we just expose the bare naked truth? Why are we in such a problem or a mess today? Why are we in this awful situation? It started somewhere. Well, when did it start? May I submit for your consideration, it started a long time ago with two contending forces. And maybe we can start it on this side of the ocean, and we can start with 1607 in our next month's lesson in January. When we do this again, we'll start in January. We'll start in 1607, and we'll see what happened. We'll take a closer look. Oh, your lectures are so long. Can't you just tell us what to do? The sovereignty of the states. This new government was to be made out of the doctrine of implied powers. Under the constructive decisions of the Supreme Court, no restrictions limit the kind of government that may be established under the doctrine of implied powers. There are no restrictions. John Marshall was the judicial exponent of Alexander Hamilton. So when you read the little 38-page pamphlet that you're taking home, the little booklet from John McManus, he will start with John Marshall. But John Marshall was the judicial exponent of Alexander Hamilton. John Marshall, Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court, longer than any other man ever served. He was a consolidationist and a Hamiltonian nationalist. I don't make these words up. These words are the words that people describe back, you know, the authors that stir and pour the fluids back and forth and make books. These are the words they use to describe John Marshall. I just recently read a book entirely on John Marshall and the Constitution, written by a Marshall lover. And very, very interesting. John Marshall. I wish I could spend an hour on John Marshall right now. I just interrupt and just stop, and we just go on to John Marshall, but we won't. Marbury versus Madison, 1803, very famous case. He declares, "It is emphatically the province and duty of the judicial department to say what the law is." Is that the duty of the judicial department? Is it really? Hamilton also, but Marshall said it was. That led to judicial review, which led to judicial supremacy, which led to the supremacist judges of today. I noticed one copy of it back on the table. I hope somebody got it. Phyllis Schlafly's great book, The Supremacist. And she's talking about the supremacist judges today. Phyllis Schlafly, anybody know who I'm talking about there? Sure, one of the great, great, wonderful hero and heroines. That is supposed to be, anyway, a wonderful woman. Beautiful too. Yes, she is. I was down speaking in Texas last year with Phyllis Schlafly and had a delightful time seeing her once again. It is emphatically, we got that one. What happened here? Did we get this one?
No.
The citizens of the states were never sovereign. Now, by the way, when I summarize, this means he did. This is not a direct quote. This is me summarizing paragraphs of reading. And so don't look in the book and expect to find that. But if you read Hamilton's Curse, page 64, you will see the source of this material. So his thinking, John Marshall's Hamiltonian nationalist consolidationist thinking was, the citizens of the states were never sovereign, and therefore they must always yield to the supremacy of the federal government. That's where we are today. You must yield to the supremacy of the federal government. Some of the worst justices ever appointed were appointed by Republican presidents. That was a Hyde slide until this morning. I just took Hyde slide off. I'm going to put that up there. Like I say, there's no there's probably nobody in here claims you're a Democrat. Bless your heart if you do. One of my greatest heroes in American history is a Democrat. Name's Larry McDonald. You remember him, don't you?
I knew him very well.
There's a man that knew him personally. Congressman Larry McDonald. He was a great freedom fighter and loved the Constitution and a Democrat. No, I'm for the Constitution. Whatever party you're in, support the principles of the Constitution in the traditional sense, and you will be on the right side. I have people all the time that tell me, oh, if we could just get John McCain in for president, he would appoint some conservative justices for the Supreme Court. Yeah, tell me about it. We haven't had a good... people don't even know what a conservative justice is, but anyway, don't be duped into the idea of thinking that a Republican president's going to appoint good justices. It is not the track record. It has not happened. Two terms that you need to be familiar with. You'll find them in the reading. Hamiltonian thinking and Jeffersonian thinking. And when they're saying Hamiltonian, I've already given you an introduction to Hamilton's thinking. And Jeffersonian, those are the contrasting viewpoints. They're the two contending forces. You know, I'm a goat keeper, and goats like to butt heads. So I had these two guys come out and butt heads. They were arch enemies. Now here's another person you don't know about. St. George Tucker. Now, I'd never heard the name St. George attached to a person. Maybe the next time you have a little boy born into your family, you can name him after a great American. Well, not bad, St. George. He was a great American, a fine, loved, and respected jurist. This is probably the earliest book on the Constitution used in law schools in America. He based it around English literature, Blackstone's Commentaries on the Law. View of the Constitution of the United States by St. George Tucker. Again, worth reading today. It is the external restraint and not the moderation of rulers that constitutes a state of liberty. So we've got to have external restraint. Don't trust the good president. Don't trust the good congressman. Put restraint on them and protect us. The Constitution is to be understood as explained by the ratifiers of the several states. So we spend all this time talking about the debates of the Federal Convention. What did they say in the debates of the Federal Convention? What did they say in the book, The Federalist? He says, don't put such high value on the Federalist and the Federal Convention. The Constitution means what it meant to the people that ratified it. Go to the state ratifying conventions and study what they believed that it meant, and you'll be closer to the truth. This is the doctrine and teachings of St. George Tucker. Example at the ratifying convention in the state of New York. Now, Alexander Hamilton was from New York. He had to convince 46 anti-federalists that the Constitution was a great program. And so what's he going to say? What's he going to do? He didn't believe it in himself. He wanted a king. He wanted a monarchy. But he's going to come up with some word. Duplicitous? Is that a word?
Duplicitous.
Can I use that here? Alexander Hamilton was duplicitous. Is that correct?
Yep.
Anyway, that's what he was. He stood up before the convention in 1788 And you can read this in Hamilton's Works, Volume 2, page 430. These are the sources. And he said, and I read this in the original, I was not satisfied to read it in the history book. I had to go find it in the original before I could believe that he actually said it. He stood up in the convention, and this is a short phrasing of a long statement. The United States Congress would never contemplate marching the troops of one state into the bosom of another for any reason. He said that. He said that to try and convince 46 anti-federalists that they would be safe in ratifying the Constitution. Don't fear, my friends. The federal government would never consider marching the troops into a state and use coercion on a state. They would never do that. Well, is there anything in the Constitution that would suggest that, that he might have used as basis for this thinking? Actually, there is. Article 4, Section 4. Now, I paraphrase it down to a short sentence. The United States government shall protect every state against invasion. Federal military force would only be permitted to enter a state by invitation. Huh? That's in the Constitution? It is. That must have been what Alexander Hamilton was referring to. Now, he did say, under any circumstance, he said it. What does it say? Marching the troops of one state into the bosom of another for any reason. Well, that's not true, because it says the reason is if the governor, or first if the state legislature, asks for the federal government to send troops, the federal government has permission. If the legislature is not in session, then the governor can ask for troops. This is in the Constitution. So Hamilton wasn't too far off there. The New York delegates, 19 Federalists, 46 Anti-Federalists. The final vote, after all the debates were over, to determine if the state of New York would ratify the proposed Constitution was 30-27. That was that close. Today, the John Warner National Defense Authorization Act, passed as an act of Congress in violation of the Constitution, declares, the President may employ the armed forces to restore public order in any state of the United States the President determines. They passed that as an act of Congress without amending the Constitution, where they have to get permission from the state legislature in the Constitution. Remember, the Constitution is to be understood as explained by the ratifiers of the several states. Now, this great hero, John Taylor of Caroline, was the intellectual leader of the Jeffersonian Republicans, and sometimes he's called the father of states' rights doctrine. He wrote it down and pronounced and encouraged states' rights. He elucidates the original intent of the founding fathers from a states' rights perspective. Enter Joseph Story, consolidationist, nationalist, professor of law at the Harvard Law School. I once saw a book advertised entitled New Views on the Constitution. Now, whose book is he referring to? John Taylor of Caroline's book. He didn't say he read it, he just saw the book. I once saw a book, probably he didn't read it because he never quoted from it once in his entire commentaries on the Constitution. He never quotes John Taylor of Caroline, who wrote the book 10 years earlier. All he has to say about it is this: I was startled. What right has a man to start new views upon it? Speculations upon our government are dangerous and should be discountenanced. Well, I can fairly say that Joseph Story was no friend of liberty. This is an interesting drawing. They drew these etchings or these engravings back in the old days. What do you suppose is going on here? Well, this is in Congress. This is the conflict between the Federalist and the Anti-Federalist. I find it, it's not very funny really, but you can see what's going on here. This guy's sitting here smiling, smoking his pipe. And these guys are beating each other up. He's cursing, waving his fist. And this guy's swinging the tongs. And this guy's swinging his cane and kicking. This guy's grinning, watching. This is Congress. back in 18, what did we get a date on there somewhere? Well, back shortly after the United States of America started, while they still had Federalist and Anti-Federalist. Two contending forces. It was in the Senate of the United States on the 16th of February in 1833 that these two theories of the Constitution stood face to face. So the year is 1833. Daniel Webster faced off with John C. Calhoun, and they had the great debate. The two contending forces were alive and well in 1833. The great God Webster, they called him back then. Now, Albert Taylor Bledsoe continues in his narrative of what happened as he explains to his children and grandchildren. He says of that event, "For the first time in the history of the country, it was solemnly asserted and argued that the Constitution of the United States was not a compact between the states." That was Daniel Webster's position. It is not a compact between the states. The Constitution was ordained and established by the whole people of the United States in their aggregate capacity as a nation. This is what he argued. But there are hundreds of pages you can read on this. It's just absolutely intriguing to find out what I never was taught all through my entire life. Blackout. They just left it out. So here's this great Daniel Webster standing up and expounding. Joseph Story supported him. He wasn't there at the debate, but he supported Webster. They worked together in what was called the Massachusetts School, a think tank of people that were consolidationist. "The Constitution is not a compact between the states. In fact, it is not a compact at all. It is a supreme law upon the states, which serve as administrative agencies." They call themselves the Consolidating School. "Sovereignty is the sum of all rights and powers," they declared. "In the Constitution, sovereignty is delegated to the central government, which is an irrevocable ceding of power." This is powerful stuff. Okay? So when the states created the Constitution, they ceded the sovereignty to the federal government. That's what he said. The Consolidating School believed states have sovereignty, except so far as they have ceded it. Oh, now we get the idea of divided sovereignty. Oh, there are even better quotes. Get down to it. Oh, pause here for a moment and deal with the words vested, delegated, and ceded. Okay, this is a problem for some people. We use ceded, we use delegated. In the Constitution, it uses vested. What's what? Will the audience please rise? Follow the directions. Would you help me, please?
Sure.
I am giving this man the box of vested powers. Hold it up high so they can see it. This is the box of vested powers on the front right here. Okay? Now, before you're qualified to do this, I must vest you with power. Okay? This is the power. I vest you with authority to carry this box. Okay? This is vested power. That makes sense, doesn't it? Now, let's go through. This idea right here, this is the Ace Hardware store. You're all unemployed and you're standing in front waiting for a job. And I'm the interviewer and you're assisting me now. I've employed you to help me. We're going through now. We need somebody to run the forklift. You look like a forklift operator. Would you please put that on? And we need somebody to run the paint booth. I want a painter. Oh, you look like a painter. Would you please put that on? You're employed as a paint booth operator? No, wouldn't hire you.
I'd like to run the cash register.
Yeah, I can tell we don't want him for the cash register. Hey, we need a cashier. Dustin, you be our cashier. He looks honest. That's why I voted for Richard Nixon, because Nixon had an honest face. Okay, that's enough probably. You get the idea? Okay, you guys, the young gals that have on a vest, please come up to the front. You have been vested with power. Please come to the front. You're now working at Ace Hardware Store. Are you the forklift operator?
I am.
Looks good, like you're the paint booth, in the paint booth?
Right.
Okay, paint, and you're the cashier. Okay. Any question what I've just done? I vested them with power. Did I cede any power to them?
No.
You're fired. Give me the vest back. You're all fired. Okay, this is what we can do. This is what we as American citizens can do with the people that we hire as public servants. We simply vested them with power. We didn't cede them anything. And this is so misunderstood. Thank you. We'll keep you. You're employed still. Vested, ceded, and delegated are key words. You will not find any hint of ceded powers anywhere in the Constitution. There are none. Now, there are different ways of using the word sovereignty. These are actual words in use. These are some we've copied down from different sources. Okay. People speak of dual sovereignty, divided sovereignty, delegated sovereignty, qualified sovereignty, limited sovereignty, representative sovereignty, federal sovereignty, sovereign powers invested in the government, surrendering essential parts of sovereignty, and state sovereignty was largely negated. These are some I've sorted out and found in different publications. Uses of the word sovereignty. Are you getting familiar with the term now? The Consolidating School contends that we have two sovereignties, but that one is sovereign over the other. Huh? Mr. Hamilton, that we have coordinate sovereignties, but that one is made superlative. This is no new problem. This has been going on since the Founding Fathers created the Constitution. There are two contending forces. Oh, yeah, if you want to be sovereign, state of Utah, you can be sovereign. We're just sovereign over you. Does that make any sense? Can you be sovereign over somebody that's sovereign? No. No. Can a state delegate some of its sovereignty to the federal government? Can you delegate sovereignty? No. See, people confuse sovereign powers. Who is going to run the cash register, Dustin? You have authority to run the cash register. Does that give you the authority to take it home at night and do what you want with it? No. I gave you specific delegated powers. You can run the cash register during the day, take the money, put it in the till, be accountable for it, but do not take it home. Are we clear? You're working for me. You're my servant. That's how we looked at public servants for a long time until they decided they were public officials. Can sovereignty be divided? Have we made it that far in this audience? I don't know if we, some faces are still kind of blank. Sovereignty, question mark. Noah versus Daniel. And when we come back and give our lessons in more detail, do not confuse Daniel Webster with Noah Webster. These are two contending people. Noah, supreme in power. The possession of the highest power. Daniel, sovereignty is the sum of all rights and powers. Is that the same? Are those harmonious definitions? No. The Consolidating School believed in the Constitution, sovereignty is delegated to the central government, which is an irrevocable ceding of power. The Consolidating School believed the states have sovereignty except so far as they have ceded it. What did the word sovereignty mean to the ratifiers? They're the ones that really count. At the state conventions, what did they determine? The constitutional researcher should seek the understanding of the ratifiers rather than the drafters, for it was the ratifiers who transformed the Constitution from a proposal into basic law. The ratifiers believed the federal government is an agent of the sovereign states and possesses only specific delegated responsibilities. Sovereignty is indivisible. Think of the word sovereignty like the word pregnancy. Either a woman is pregnant or she is not pregnant. There is no such thing as divided pregnancy. Likewise, there is no such thing as divided sovereignty. Now we beat that one over and over, twisted it. Okay, we hope we could grasp it. Two sovereignties cannot coexist within the same limits. Well, that's the truth. Two sovereignties cannot coexist within the same limits. We must establish a complete sovereignty in the general government. The general power, if it preserves itself, must swallow up the state powers. Is there any question where he's coming from? Thank you. Now, here's a guy that we don't hear much about, Andrew Johnson. He took the place of Abraham Lincoln on the assassination of the president, became the president of the United States. In Philadelphia, August the 14th, 1866, a political convention was held of a new political party, the National Union Convention. Remember, Abraham Lincoln won the first election as a Republican and the second election as a National Union Party. And then Andrew Johnson would be the only other president that was part of the National Union Party. So they were holding their great convention for the National Union Party. The President of the United States is up in front, and he's speaking. And this is another case where I couldn't stand it. I went to the original source, and I read it from the original notes of the National Convention Party. "I consider the proceedings of this convention equal to, if not more important, than those of any convention that ever assembled in the United States." And the notes kept track of what happened then. Great applause. Okay, I thought that was fun to hear what's going on. Now, at that convention, this is what was determined. The National Union, and it's not the president speaking, it's another speaker. The National Union Convention of 1866, they declared, "The insurrection against the supreme authority of the nation has been suppressed." Now, what's this insurrection? That's the South rising up in insurrection against the government. "The insurrection against the supreme authority of the nation." Notice the terms there. The supreme authority of the nation. Where's that coming from? That's the consolidationist school. That's what we've been showing you, the two contending forces, the consolidationist school. "The victory achieved by the national government has been final and decisive." The national government? Did we have a national government? Or did we have a federal government? Before 1861, we had a federal government. And after 1863, at the Gettysburg Address, then we had a new nation. Huh? What's this guy up here talking about? This is the history of the United States. A national government. "The victory achieved by the national government has been final and decisive. It has established beyond all further controversy, and by the highest of all human sanction, the absolute supremacy of the national government." Isn't that interesting? This was a long time before Ronald Reagan. If we could just go back to Ronald Reagan, would everything be okay? Not hardly. If we could go back to George Washington, would everything be okay? People are appalled when I say Ivan Eland put George Washington as number 9 with respect to peace, prosperity, and his support of the Constitution of the United States. He got ranking number 9 from that one professor. And I tend to agree that he's not number 1. And John Tyler did a better job. Well, let's see what happened here. George Washington was elected. He chose Thomas Jefferson as Secretary of State. And he chose Alexander Hamilton as Secretary of Treasury. Now, these are two arch enemies. And then Alexander Hamilton proposed a national debt and a national bank. "We have the implied powers to do anything we think is necessary and proper." And George Washington said, "Would you both submit in writing your defense of your position?" So Hamilton wrote his statement. Oh, and you'll learn from it today if you read Hamilton's statement of why we should have a national bank. And Thomas Jefferson wrote his why we shouldn't have a national bank. And they submitted them to George Washington, and he sided with Hamilton. And Thomas Jefferson resigned. A Federalist President, John Adams, in 1798, signed the Sedition and Rebellion Act, or Alien and Sedition Act. He also appointed midnight judges, they call them. last-ditch chance before the horrible Thomas Jefferson administration comes in. The opposite viewpoint had just won the election. And so it's his last chance now to see if he can get some judges in that have common sense and intelligence like John Marshall. And so he appointed John Marshall and others to judgeships. In the Alien and Sedition Acts, it did four things. The one that was the most offensive was number four, the Sedition Act. In the Sedition Act, it reads, "It shall be a criminal offense to oppose any federal law or publish any false, scandalous, and malicious writing against the government of the United States or either House of Congress or the President of the United States with an intent to defame or bring them or either of them into contempt or disrepute." So you can't write anything bad about the government. Even if it's true, it doesn't matter. You can't write it. Now, this did not go over very well with the opposing or the contending the other force. They thought that was an unjust and an inappropriate law. The big question, was there a lawful way in which the people might express their opposition to this federalist legislation? So if the government today passes a law that is in violation of the Constitution, is there a lawful, peaceful way to contest it? They had that question then. John Taylor of Caroline, now he shined at this time. He declared the right of the state government to expound the Constitution might possibly be made the basis of a movement toward amendment. Now he's not talking about amending the Constitution, but changing an unconstitutional law. The states, he points out, have the right to expound what the Constitution means. The people in conventions of states are incontrovertibly the contracting parties. It's a contract between states, and the people in the states can go through their state government to contest an inappropriate law like the Alien and Sedition Acts. This came to be known as the compact theory of the Constitution. James Madison, June 29, 1821. "Our government system is established by compact, not between the government of the United States and the state governments, but between the states as sovereign communities." Now from this rose these two resolutions. The year was 1798. James Madison in Virginia, Thomas Jefferson in Kentucky, and they brought forth resolutions they called the Resolutions of 98. It's great reading. You can Google any of this up. None of this is secret. The first principle of the Constitution, they declared in the Resolutions of 98, "The federal union rests upon a compact between free, sovereign, independent states. Whensoever the general government assumes undelegated powers, its acts are unauthoritative, void, and of no force." Two states agreed and published this as resolutions. Just like the states now are passing resolutions. Now, a resolution has no teeth. All it is the opinion of the delegates of a state. This was the opinion of the delegates of the states of Kentucky and Virginia. Now the years have passed by. Daniel Webster's getting old. I'm trying to represent him here near death. And gone. He wanted to be the President of the United States. No longer. He can't. No hope for that now. He's an old man ready to die. Gone is the dazzling prize of the presidency. Before me lies the darkness of the grave. And still the greater darkness that threatens my native land with ruin. He could see the horrible mess that America was in. It's 1852, I believe the year is. And he declares, "Remember the compact of the Constitution." This is just the opposite of what he said 5 and 10 years before. Just the opposite. It was deliberately entered into by the states. Do you remember what he said before? The Constitution was created by the great aggregate of all the people together. Oh no. Now he says it was a compact between the states. By the way, a compact is a contract between states. Don't let that confuse you. I taught fifth grade for 20 minutes last year, and in the fifth grade they could handle this. A contract is called a compact if it's between states. and the compact constitutes the plan of government. And since the compact constitutes the plan of government, they call it a constitution. Ah, that was not too hard to get on. And the teacher, at the end of my 20 minutes, she says, gee, Mr. Pratt, that was really good. Next year we'll give you 30 minutes. Okay? So, if Noah Webster had a tombstone, what would we put on his tombstone? Oh, they're supposed to see it that a different way. Here we go. There we go. Here lies Daniel Webster, 1782 to 1852. Great expounder or great deceiver? See, his associates and supporters call him the great expounder, the great God Webster. Had a great fan following. Or was he a great deceiver? Albert Taylor Bledsoe goes on. The Great War of Coercion. Isn't that an interesting word for what we call a civil war? That's more descriptive of what it really was. Free, sovereign, independent states were coerced into complying with the whims of the gigantic faction of 1861. The Great War of Coercion shifted the federal government from the basis of compact to that of conquest. What we then lost, we never got back. Now we're back to where we started. News flash, March the 30th, taking on the feds. All of us have taken an oath to uphold the Constitution. And the Constitution either means what it says or it means nothing. The state sovereignty movement, or 10th Amendment movement. We're back to, we got three slides or so left here to summarize what we started with. This is going on now. There is a state sovereignty movement alive and well in America today. Seven states have passed the resolution demanding their sovereignty back. This serves as notice and demand to the federal government as our agent to cease and desist effective immediately. Mandates that are beyond the scope of the constitutionally delegated powers. The state of Oklahoma hereby claims sovereignty under the 10th Amendment to the Constitution of the United States. In the back of the John McManus pamphlet that we want you all to go home and read, you will see a proposed 10th Amendment resolution. He does a nice job there, giving a suggestion for every state, something they could put together and pass in the state legislature, just like seven states have already done. Just like, oh, here we go. Just love these movie pictures. Rachel Dawes and Bruce Wayne. What did they say? Have you got it memorized? It's what you do that defines you. It's not how you feel. It's not what you feel inside that counts. It's what you do that defines you. It's what you do that defines you. So when you leave here tonight, it's not what you felt. It's what you do that defines you. Know your liberty. We're going to be back in Orem. We're going to do it in January. We have dates already set up in St. George, so it'll have to be the last of January, 1st of February, along in there. We'll announce that as we get closer to the date. You all should have filled out a card and left it with us. We have your contact information. We'd like to inform you when we're coming again. There is no charge. And as you figured out, I hope we sell nothing, but we hope you will read. We hope you can contribute enough to cover my cost. And if you don't, accept the books as a gift. If you read them, it's like a smorgasbord. Back on the table, we have a smorgasbord of literature. And when you go to the smorgasbord, often you'll see a little sign as to eat what you take. Okay? If you take a book, read it. This is a special moment for me right here. This is the closing, getting to the close. Where is this? That's Independence Hall. But unlike all of the other pictures in this series, I took this one myself. All the others I stole. You know, borrowed them out of magazines. I stood in front of Independence Hall with my son. It was July the 5th, 2007. It was 10 minutes past 6 in the evening. We had just finished our day's work. We had finished a contract with the federal government. We had installed a printing press in one of the government printing offices on which they could print the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence. And that was a special moment for me. And I thought, if they would just stop and read it. It was in Benjamin Franklin's grandson's print shop, a legitimate government printing office. And they print on them every day, 7 days a week. They print on our printing press the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence and other related documents. Now our work is done. We finished our installation. We're soon to receive your tax dollars. Yes. And we stood in front of this building, and I was a little awestruck because I'd never seen it before. And among other things, I pledged that I would never go and see it again in downtown Philadelphia. As I stood there and I meditated, it was almost deserted by now. 6:10, the tour guides had all gone home. The crowds had all dissipated. The streets were almost bare the day after the 4th of July at Independence Hall. And I imagined I could see why I think I do. Yes, I can see the spirit of George Washington. He's standing out in front. And in front of him is a table. And on the table are two documents, the Constitution of the United States and the Declaration of Independence. And George Washington is holding out the pen, and every tourist that walks by, he's pleading with him. Would you sign? Would you endorse? Would you support? Would you uphold and defend? And the people walk by munching on their popcorn and eating their cotton candy, and they don't even see him. Millions of them every year go through this exhibit. And if he could speak, and if I were capable of putting words in his mouth, which I'm not, I would have him say this: there is indeed a cause, and God is waiting for his people to stand in faith, to let their light shine in the darkness that threatens to engulf us. Can he count on you? That's what I'd like him to say. America is a Christian nation. You've noticed these beautiful paintings around here this evening, a lovely exhibit of paintings of our Savior, our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. I love to close with this slide because I believe in Christ. And when we teach our first lesson in the story of America, we will start in a cradle in Bethlehem as the foundation of this land. Jesus was in a closed room, only hours away from all the misery and death that comes to our great Savior. His closest friends were with him. He turns to one of them and he says, "Simon, Simon, Satan desireth thee to sift thee as wheat. But I have prayed for thee that thy faith fail not. When thou art converted, strengthen thy brethren." I am converted. The gospel of Jesus Christ is the perfect law of liberty. And that includes the liberty to speak, the liberty to live in a land of free people. I am converted. And when thou art converted, strengthen thy brethren. That is our charge. And I publicly thank Joe Ferguson for helping me many, many years ago to come to love my country. Thank you, Joe.